screen. For anyone who's either listening to this recording or not familiar with what we do, HMTRI has these professional learning community calls. We have them in cycles, and in each cycle there's 10 calls, and they're every 2 weeks for 30 minutes. And we talk about developing job training programs, hints, do's and don'ts, upcoming events in Washington, different things that may have been interest the people on the call. And we have about 150 people who come and go from these calls, and we send post-session notes out to everyone. If you're not on the list or if you have not gotten an email from me, just send me a note at msenew@aol.com. That's S like in Sam, ENEW@AOL.com. And for those who missed the call, they can listen to recordings, or they can go to our toolbox, which Glo will explain in a second, or they will get post-session notes that will also be included for everyone on the list. This cycle, we're actually in the ninth call of this cycle of 10 calls. The next one is going to be on the 22nd of May after the Brownfields Conference, and that wrap-up call will be about the state of job training, the EPA job training program, and where it's going in the future, and some hints on how we might position ourselves for job training in the next year or two. So with that, we always start these calls with Glo giving us kind of an update of what she's heard and her interaction with EPA. Glo, anything that you may want to talk about from Washington?
Yeah, actually, I talked to Jill this morning. And also, Mike, I'm having a hard time hearing you. I can hear everyone else, but I'm having a hard time hearing you. So
okay.
Maybe you want to talk louder. I don't know if I'm the only one, but...
Will do.
I did talk to Joe Bruss from headquarters this morning, and he said that yesterday they had their first grant panel, and they were actually going to be meeting again tomorrow. So right now he's saying that they are on track for an early June announcement of this year's grantees, which is a good thing.
The early June is great because usually it slips into July or August.
Mm-hmm.
So that is
that's really
wonderful.
Helpful.
Hopefully they can keep on that track, but like I said, they met yesterday. They're meeting again tomorrow. So it sounds like right now they're moving right along.
Right. Now, usually the word comes from Glo, when they award these grants, does it usually come through the congressman first that announces it, and then, or sometimes they're notified by EPA first?
I thought they were notified by EPA, but that might not be right. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. What will happen is the people that are on the grant will get phone calls, and you may get a call in terms of a negotiation also. That may happen, where they may come and ask some final questions in terms of your budget or locking some things down. But if you have not heard from them at this point, you're in the running, and they're in the evaluation phase of the criteria. So that's a positive thing. And Joe has not indicated to us how many submissions he has gotten. Has he? Have you gotten any indications of how many people submitted?
No, he hasn't told me that either.
No. There will be about 11 or 12.
A week or so ago, he did tell me that they got less than they usually do, but still he didn't give me any numbers, so I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Someone just joined?
Christine Campbell, Clover Park Technical College, Lakewood, Washington.
Hey Christine.
Hi.
We indicated that the re-ups, and about 5 of the 10 to 12, depending on what happens with their budget cuts, 10 to 12 grantees will be awarded. They usually, about half of them are re-ups, people who've had grants that have expired and are eligible to reapply, and then about five new ones, so five or six or seven. So they're fairly flexible on that. So that'll be happening in June. And then, Glo, do you want to tell us a little bit about the annual grantee meeting that'll be coming up after that?
Yeah, we just confirmed that this week. I just made the announcement for the annual grantee meeting, which is where we bring together all past and present people that have been funded with EPA dollars to come together and share best practices, share their problems, how they worked them out. It's a networking meeting for the grantees. The grantees, when they register, they will tell me three topics that they want to talk about during the meeting, and those are always included in the agenda. The agenda is both large group and small group, so that we can get in as many topics as we can. This year's meeting is going to be on September 18th and 19th at the Sheraton Old Town in Alexandria, Virginia. We're going to start it out, the meeting on, it's a Wednesday and Thursday. We're going to start it out with an optional safety meeting course, and then the grantee meeting itself starts at 6 p.m. that night and then runs all day the next day from 8 until 6:30.
Now, you're going to be sending out announcements and invites and...
I put it out on the listserv yesterday, and I'm going to be sending it to the EPA regions today or tomorrow.
Okay. Also, as part of this annual grantee meeting, people who are participants in the professional learning communities, these weekly or biweekly calls, also could attend. They may not have a grant at the moment, but they're seriously considering that grant. And, of course, It's a free workshop. You have to get there yourself, though. If you can get to Alexandria, drive or fly, pretty much the rest of the workshop is paid for. There is a lunch provided.
Including lodging.
Food and
the
lodging
we pay
dinner.
For two nights, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you get two nights. You'd have to pay for one night's dinner, but there's a big lunch. So any of the PLC members who attend these calls will be able to come. And as I had indicated earlier, in 2 weeks, on the 22nd, we'll have the 10th of this cycle, and then we'll start a new cycle beginning of June for the new grantees, and that'll roll into the annual grantee meeting. So We're encouraging everyone to come. It's a great workshop, and encourage everyone to attend. And, of course, as I had mentioned before, we're going to be at the Brownfields annual 2013 Brownfields Conference. We're going to have a booth, and anyone who wants to bring materials, bring your materials to our booth, and we'll put them out. So if you have any flyers, anything about your program, look us up, the HMTRI booth. It says HMTRI or ATEC, Eastern Iowa Community College. Is that correct, Glo, how we're registered?
Right, yes.
So look
under
HMTRI.
Yeah, we're registered as HMTRI and ATEC.
Okay. And just stop by our booth. We'll be setting that up on Tuesday and Wednesday, and then we'll put your materials out. We're also going to have a session on Friday from 11:15 to 12:45, and I have put those in the session notes, and we're encouraging all the grantees or anyone who's attending to the workshop to come to our little workshop. It's in Marketplace of Ideas. It's going to be in room B403 and 404, and we're going to have some very experienced people, Art Shanks and Tippi Reed from OAI and Arch Hanks from Cypress Mandela, and we're going to have Lena Miller from Hunter's Point, who we've talked about, talking about their programs. And Lena and Art worked together, and Art helped them secure grant in the Sam Hunter's Point area. So they're going to talk about their programs. And then we're really going to talk around the room of the people that are there about their programs, and again, bringing their materials and sharing them with the group. And we'll talk all about the direction of job training, about issues related to these job training programs, basically an overall open discussion on the positives and negatives of running these programs. So if you get to Brownfields, I encourage that. What we'll do also on the 22nd of May, we'll kind of give a summary for those people who weren't able to attend. So we'll try to collect as much material as we can and present it to those people who are not able to be there. One of the things we're going to talk about today, and we've talked about this many times, this is kind of, it's not a rerun, but it's so important in these programs, is the recruitment assessment. Last week we talked about the assessment process of once you recruit your students, how you assess them. And we talked about the different strategies. Some people leave it up to the workforce investment boards, and then others do their own recruiting. And some use a combination of the workforce investment boards and their own. And, of course, each has positives and negatives. The criticisms that people have with the letting the workforce investment boards do the recruiting is the question of we only have, what we hear is we have 25 slots, and this program requires a lot of dedication, and it requires a certain type of individual, and we need control over that individual. And usually the workforce investment boards give you that latitude. They do provide a lot of services. And usually the grantees that we talk to who do work with the workforce investment boards have had fairly positive experiences. I was at Durham Tech this morning, and the individual from the Workforce Investment Board, the interesting thing about the Durham Tech program, and they've had three grants from EPA. What makes this an outstanding program is not so much that they graduate many, many graduates, but they have a really good integration between the Workforce Investment Board, the trainers or the community college, and the employers. And today we had a open house, a workshop with employers and with the Workforce Investment Board and with some students that had gone through the program. And the interesting thing is the grant in Durham is actually awarded to the city, and then the city is in partnership with the community college, and the Workforce Investment Board is a partner in that whole process. So they're very closely integrated. And the things that the Workforce Investment Board also brings to the table in terms of potential hires is also ancillary programs that are provided by WEA. And one good example of this, for example, is the on-the-job training for employers. It just so happens that in North Carolina, and every state is different, so this may or may not apply to your state, there are funds in the Workforce Investment Act that allow for on-the-job training, and it allows for if someone goes through the workforce investment system, if they're WEA participants and they're referred to the program and they go through the training program, the employer, or it could be offered to the employer, can get up to 6 months of remuneration for the salary of that employee. So they look at it as most employees are put on a probation period of about 90 days, and they have a sliding scale. If you're a small under 50 employees, they'll pay 100%, or then it slides down to 90%, and then it slides down to 75%, and if you're a large corporation, it'd be 50%. But they'll pay for that the first as much as first 6 months of that employee's employment, which gives the employer an added incentive to hire the graduate. And they're working with the grantee, with the training program, and even to the point where if the program recruits an individual, they could work backwards in a reverse referral, and they can send that individual to the Workforce Investment Board, and they can sign them up retroactively as a participant, as a WIA participant, and then get him back into the program, and then he qualifies for the on-the-job training. So what could be better than to offer an employer not only someone who's got thousands of dollars worth of certification, but also 6 months of salary paid, and it's a great incentive for employers. And of course, at this workshop, they had employers, and again, they've got this very much integrated. They're all working together. They had several employers who had been employing the students from this program, and one of the most proactive people in the program was actually an employer, and he was not only an advocate of the program, he was almost a de facto member of this job training program. He was promoting it. He had done some studies of how much their company had saved. He came up with $11,000 is actually what they saved, and there's several thousand dollars worth of certificates that we're all aware of, but then also, in addition to that, there were time lost, time in travel, productivity, and when their firm looked at all of these costs associated with new hires, they found that they were saving about $11,000. And, of course, in addition to that, they were also getting pre-screened individuals who had the ability to stick with the program, who were never tardy to any of the training programs. So it was just a win-win situation. But what was interesting about this whole system that I was observing was how integrated it was, that involvement of the employers. And, of course, the other thing about the employers is they had tremendous input into the program. They had about a half dozen employers who just so happened in this area, there's a lot of redevelopment going on. These are abandoned warehouses. They might be factories, abandoned factories, very similar to most communities that you'd have in Pittsburgh or out in the Oregon area or Washington area. We're doing a lot of work in RRMP, which is the lead removal. When there wasn't lead, there was usually asbestos. So they had a large focus on lead and asbestos certifications. They also found that there was this need for wastewater treatment, and they were providing wastewater treatment certifications, a level one certification, which is the lowest level, and then allowing the student, if he could use that, to get his foot into the wastewater treatment plant, and then with the hope that he would get a level two certification once that he was employed by the wastewater plant people. But this integration between the employer and the community college and the WIB, and also all of that involved and integrated into the screening of the input of the students. It works in a system. And there was every intent of everyone, they were going to recruit 25 people, and they anticipated in placing all 25 people per cycle. They were going to have three cycles of 25, which is fairly typical of these grants, and they were going to place all 25. Last week we talked about the different assessment tests that if you look at the post-session notes, the TABE, which many of you use, the work keys, which others use, and the CASAS, the CASAS, which other people use. And they each have strong points and weak points. Most of them give you credentials that you could use as a placement tool also that employers are looking for. And in addition to those aptitude tests, they, of course, screen for driver's license, Social Security, green card, high school certificates. Most everyone has orientation meetings. They often do at least one or two interviews. Certainly do drug tests. There are a few that once they're in the program, they have to be sure that they're drug-free as they go through the program. Most of our grantees will test before they get into the program, but some do it after they get into the program. So, and then, of course, they all do this final interview. But given all of those rigors that the person has to go through, a test doesn't really give you a reading on will that person come to every class? Will he be on time? And that's a tough one. Will they be reliable? Or are they just without a job and have nothing better to do than to take this course? And this is where the WIB and the independent review of the program, this is where the program has to step in, and they have to get a feel for that student. Does he have the perseverance and the interest in environmental job training to do this? They had some graduates today, and his employer was there, and he said, you know, not only did he go through this program, and he was there every day on time, never late, but after he got the job, he'll spend winters in Kansas City in snow and ice and summers when it's hot in Florida, and he's going to be traveling all over the country, and it's a tough job. And they were doing waste site remediation and under very difficult conditions. And, of course, the grantee, the participant in the program, the graduate of the program, said, yeah, it's exactly right. We go here and we go there, and the conditions are difficult, but I love it. And he says, I love this job. This is the best thing that ever happened to me. And this recruitment process that they employed, they were able to find candidates in their community that had this attitude of, yes, I'm willing to go to Florida when it's blazing hot, and I don't mind going to Kansas City when it's cold, and I don't mind working with my hands above my head or working in difficult suits. I'm willing to endure this, and I'm reliable. So this is something that the one-stop may not be able to determine as they refer clients to you, but that's something that you have to determine on your own. So out in Clover Park, you all have had this. You've gone through this several times, haven't you? And with screening students, and how do you handle it out there,
Christina? Yeah, well, I shared last time we have a rather lengthy screening process, and it includes CASAS testing. We don't drug test. The college kind of balked at that because we don't make every student that comes to the college take a drug test. So I'm still trying to figure out a way around that. But they come in and they do several intake meetings with our recruiting partner, Metropolitan Development Council, and then they come to an overall orientation that all the candidates are invited to. If they don't come for that, they're dropped. And CASAS, they have to perform reading and math at a 10th grade level, which you seem to be kind of high based on other people's cutoff scores. But we found for the math especially, if they get much lower than that, they can't get through the environmental chemistry math very easily, and we wind up losing them. And
now, do you use the Workforce Investment Board at all, or are you doing this all independent?
Oh, we absolutely use them. They're one of our partners. Ours is called Workforce Central out here. They're one of our partners. We have a dedicated staff person. He goes through, and we don't require WEA eligibility, but he goes through every candidate once the final group is selected, finds out who qualifies for extra support from WEA. He sets up internships. We're still working on the longer-term on-the-job training, which kind of requires hiring. the employers we've been working with are kind of reluctant to hire out of the box, but a lot of them are doing internships. And well, so we're working on that end.
You brought up an interesting point. You can actually do retrofit, actually get them back into the WIA system, even if say an alumni recruits his brother and
right.
says, I've got a brother or a cousin who wants to go into this program, and they come to you, you can get them back into WIA? Is that correct? So they can apply for additional benefits?
Correct.
Is that correct?
Absolutely. We run everybody through that WIA eligibility process.
Is everyone WIA qualified, or do you have a mix that some are and some aren't?
We don't require that they be WIA qualified, and some of them don't qualify. But we want to make sure that those who do qualify get that extra support, because they'll you know, once they get hired, they'll provide work boots for them. They provide all kinds of stuff for them. So we try to get everyone possible, approved for that extra support.
I heard this morning from the WIB also. They will provide boots. They will provide, if there's some equipment that they need to
right.
do their job, they provide
right.
all those things. It's wonderful.
And they also help with transportation while the training's going on. They can subsidize them for bus tickets so that they, if somebody's really struggling and trying to get on their feet and can't afford the transit fare, if they're WIA eligible, they provide them with transportation support. So there's just a lot of things that they provide. They will also pay for them to get extra certifications. For example, if we don't offer a certain certification, that would help them have a better package if they're WIA eligible. Once they successfully complete our program, WIA will often pay for them to do that, provided they have a prospective employer in the works who will say, yes, if they had this one additional certification, we would hire them. They'll pay for them to get that, too.
Wonderful. So the takeaway is whether you're doing self-recruitment or you're getting referrals from them, you really need to partner up with them and make sure you're in sync with them.
Right. Well, and they help get them jobs. I know Brandon, our designated Workforce Central staff person, he's constantly out there combing for jobs through the Business Connection service that they offer. And he, for each class that we add on, he adds those folks that successfully graduate onto his email list. And any time a job comes up that looks like it fits their package of credentials and history, he sends out a blanket email to everybody letting them know what jobs are out there and gives them, they click on the link and they get the employment information and application information and all that. So that's an ongoing follow-up after they leave the program.
Now, the criticism I've heard, and every Workforce Investment Board is different in every community, and some are really good and some aren't as great, is they're sending over applicants. If someone, it becomes a bureaucratic issue where they're trying to fit, they've got all kinds of people coming into the program and they start sending them over, and the quality of the referrals you're getting. Do you have an issue with that, or how do you address that issue?
No, because we don't get our referrals from that. Well, if they refer someone, they have to go through our whole process. And typically we don't get people referred from them as much as we get them outreaching to employers and providing job leads and trying to set up internships. Brandon comes to all of our class functions, shows up at class once in a while in case anybody has questions for him. So we work very, very closely with our people here in Pierce County.
Excellent. Anyone else have any other experiences in that light in terms of that recruitment and working with investment boards and positive or negative experiences?
He also does our job fit analysis. For everyone that wants to get into the program, he runs them through their job fit to see if they're good candidates for that type of work.
Now, who administers the test? Do you do that yourself, or do you?
Mm-hmm. The CASIS, our recruiting partner, Metropolitan Development Council, has our main person that does our recruiting intake through them. is CASAS certified, so she does those tests.
And CASAS can also provide you with a certification that you could also use for placement at some point when it's that time to place the students, I guess. So.
Right. Well, if they're actually coming into, if they decide to jump from our program into our environmental science program here at the college, they still have to take the COMPASS test, which is a little more involved than CASAS to place them. But typically, because we have such a high cutoff for CASAS, they do okay on those.
I remember from the last call, your cutoff is significantly higher than others, but I expect you have
10th grade level.
But I expect you have a good success rate, too. So how do you screen for this issue of persistence and tenacity and interest?
I wish I knew. I'd make a fortune if I could market it. We always have three or four that wind up flaking out on us for one reason or another. I mean, and sometimes people have family crises that come up. You know, these things, some of these things are unavoidable. But, you know, every once in a while we get somebody who's coming because their mother's beating them about the head and shoulders to get a job. So they wound up interviewing really well, let's put it that way. But they didn't really have the commitment. And then when they found out how much work it was, they just sort of drift off into the stratosphere. So I don't have that perfected yet. We've tried all kinds of different things. We've done personal interviews with a panel with our all of our partners together. We've done telephone interviews, and we've tried all kinds of different things. And inevitably, we lose at least two out of every program.
Yeah, and I think everyone struggles with that. And you can't tell. You can. I think the more experience you have, you get a feel for.
Well, some of them you can kind of get a feel, but others surprise you.
Mm-hmm.
Mike.
Yes.
Hello. I have a question I wanted to ask her. This is Vanessa Frazier. She mentioned that they lose at least two out of every program. Mm-hmm. Is that per class?
That's per class.
Okay, so depending on when they drop out or have to be put out, do you replace those two, or is it too far along in the program where you have to move on without the two and come up with short?
Point early on, because our components are kind of stacked. They build on each other. There comes a point where you just can't bring somebody in the middle of it,
right,
and have them succeed. So we try to do some of the stuff up front, like the first aid CPR and the OSHA safety. That kind of tells us if somebody's going to be showing up on time and be engaged or be using their cell phone during the whole class or this or that. And when we get to the more substantive stuff, by then we pretty well have a handle on who's going to make it and who's not. So we try to front load the easier stuff.
Okay.
And use that as our getting to know you time. And we can pretty well tell by the end of their safety, because we run our safety for 24 hours. We do the OSHA 10, but then we also have a Washington Safety and Health Act that we incorporate that material into it all as well as some hands-on. So by the time we're done with that, we have a pretty good idea and who we need to be sitting down and having a come-to-the-Lord talk with far as are they going to straighten out and continue or leave.
It really demonstrates the importance of recruitment, because you're launching the boat, and everyone on the boat's got to get to the other side, and it's a tough call, because if the mistake is made in the very front, the rest of the program is pure torture, or could be really good, depending on that class. And
the ones that constantly seem to flout the rules, if you will, or keep using texting and using their phone even after they're repeatedly told of that, it disrupts the whole rest of the class. You know, you last time we had a guy that kept falling asleep. So half the class would start watching him falling asleep and laughing. So we had to ask him to leave. You know, when you're ready to get serious, come back. But you can't sit here in class and sleep.
That's right.
Can I ask? Sorry, this is Sarah from Jacksonville. I just have one question about the assessment, because we have recently, I have, whenever we do our screening, it's pretty vigorous, I guess. We do interviews and do orientations and drug screening and tape testing. But if you have an individual that is not, has anyone had the, I guess, the circumstance where someone hasn't been accepted into the program? And the question that I really had is, I had a lot of issues with what they call here selective admissions, mm-hmm. and they wanted a very formal outline, or the gentleman did, as to why he wasn't selected. And I don't normally, whenever we do it, we do a panel interview, we do phone interviews, and then we normally do a one-on-one interview. And he just wasn't necessarily, his need wasn't as great, was the main reason he wasn't selected for the program. But I didn't know if anyone else had experienced that, or had that, you know, had been asked by any people that had not been admitted into the program that wanted to receive the training. Because the way it is now, I told him whenever we have another training, he's welcome to reapply then. But at that time, with the group that had applied, his need was not as great as the others. So that was the main reason he wasn't selected.
That's pretty well the way we do it, too. Yes, we have had people query, and we have told them they'll be on a waiting list for the next class.
Okay, but you pretty much, and no other sort of issues behind it, like five-page email.
Well, we've had a couple of people say we discriminated against them because of race, which we can easily dispute because we always have mixed-race classes. So,
right.
You know, it's pretty obvious that that wasn't the reason.
Right. Okay, well thank you.
You obviously, when you certainly have the assessment tests, which are objective, but then the rest of the criteria and the drug tests, but then the rest of the issues are subjective. And as with EPA in awarding grantees, they always leave the final decision as a subjective decision based on additional parameters. And in fact, in the submission of the grants, they have other factors now. And in your case, those, it may require in a sticky situation to document the other factors. In your case, it was a question of need. It may be if you only have 25 seats, you've got a very limited resource, and you have to select, in your opinion, those who are best fit for the program. And you may have to just indicate that, as you would in any selection process, that even though they passed these tests, it was your opinion or the panel's opinion that they were not the best fit for this particular program. And,
right. We pretty much now what we've kind of have concluded that we're going to have to, just as far as documentation, because when we do our interview questions, we do an interview and people jot things down, but what the college is wanting us now is to have more of a the same sort of document for every person, and to have, you know, little check boxes, you know, like
right.
Did meet, exceeds, does not meet. So just for documentation, I just didn't know if any other grantees had that same sort of situation.
And we'll bring this point up in our workshop at Brownfields next Friday. And it's an interesting point. And just like the ranking criteria, there's a certain, they're trying to make something subjective more objective, where you could have a panel and have certain criteria that, you know, does this person fit this particular position in your opinion? And just the fact that it's documented and you have, you know, like, as you say, check boxes or some sort of rank, at least you've got some written documentation that will cover you in that rare case that might occur.
Right.
Very good point.
Thank you.
Well, we try to keep these to 30 minutes, and we'll write these up in post-session notes, and then, of course, Well, our next session will be on the 22nd of May after Brownfields. And as I said, anyone going there, come to our booth in the workshop. And we're going to be talking about all these same issues, similar issues. And then, of course, we'll be starting a new cycle after that. But I'll send everyone post-session notes. And then, and in the meantime, anything we hear from EPA regarding existing grants, we'll pass it on to everyone. So thanks for the call, and we'll talk to you all soon. Have a good
day. Okay.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Jeez and crackers. Okay.
Love that color.
Thank you. It's my favorite spring and summer color.
Yeah, it's a beautiful color. So refreshing. I got a t-shirt.
What?
I got a t-shirt that I haven't worn yet that's hopefully that color. You know what I mean? Because when I looked at it, I thought it's the color, but you don't know until it's on.
Right.
So, but it's really beautiful.
Well, sure, you have very good taste.
Well, see, you know how color is so mutable. So.
Did you get any of Jerry's pottery?
I did. I love what I got.
What did you get? Let me see. Oh, wait a minute.
Let me see yours.
I love this.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay.
all yeah. Yeah, many in India.
Many.
Hundreds.
Well, I mean, in the United States, there are not many.
Yeah.